Susan Glasser. This week on the Global Politico, something a little bit different. 10 things we've learned, or not learned, as the case may be, about Donald Trump and the rest of the world. America will come back from its summer vacation still just as puzzled in many ways as we were back on January 20th. Is Donald Trump the master of deals or a disruptor, a wrecking ball or a historical change agent? And when it comes to foreign policy, just what is it? Does he have a Trump doctrine? What is an America First foreign policy? Is he a neo-isolationist who's going to withdraw us to Fortress America? Or a military brass-loving tough guy who surrounded himself with generals and will do as they say, even if, as we learned last week in Afghanistan, quite reluctantly? Well, we've had about 6 months of the Global Politico, this podcast we started back in February. We've had three former secretaries of state come on and join us, two national security advisors, two sitting prime ministers, and a former European one. The bottom line is, all these folks have shared their wisdom with us. What I've been surprised by, I have to say, is the fact that our obsession has many ways circled back to one person and one person only, Donald Trump. It's been a lot more Kremlinology about the Trump administration and the Trump White House than I expected when we launched the Global Politico. Now, sure, we've taken road trips to Iraqi Kurdistan, to the UK for the British parliamentary elections. We've talked with people about crises all over the world, from Venezuela and its unraveling, to what's going on in the Middle East, to North Korea, of course. But in many ways, the single-minded focus of all of our guests, both those who are American and those who are from elsewhere in the world, has really been in trying to understand the personality, the predilections, and just what is going on with America's volatile new president. So I thought it would be useful to take stock of what exactly we've learned from all those interviews and conversations about Donald Trump over the months. Number one, this one, it seems to me, is without dispute. Donald Trump is unpredictable by design. It goes back to our very first exchange on this podcast in our inaugural interview with former Secretary of State and former White House Chief of Staff, Jim Baker. This first exchange really captured a lot of what we're dealing with, even now, months later, with Donald Trump.
When you look at a White House, you definitely have to look at the major players. I do firmly believe in that preparation prevents poor performance. I think, for instance, that the rollout of this recent temporary ban on travel from seven countries could have been done better. The process is really important in the White House. How you roll out policies can oftentimes be every bit as important as what the policy itself is. And the rollout here was deficient. I think we have to acknowledge that. The president's own cabinet officers were not fully briefed in advance. They weren't consulted in too much detail, if at all. And the Congress was never consulted. You find in if you spend much time in a White House, that the way we judge our presidents is on the basis of how many of their policies they can implement, turn into law, and the way you normally do that is with the aid and assistance of the other co-equal branch of government, the Congress. And if you want the Congress to be in on the landing of a policy, they got to be in on the takeoff. And there was, I think, a lack of preparation or consultation here. There's nothing wrong with a president implementing a controversial policy to fulfill a campaign obligation. And in fact, there's something good about that in terms of setting a standard that, or letting people know that this is a president who's going to keep his promises and keep his commitments. But the way you do it is so very, very important when you get up there in Washington.
So that was Jim Baker in our very first exchange at the Global Politico when I flew down to Texas to talk to him in the first days of the Trump administration. Interestingly enough, that interview really sort of went viral. And I think it was because it was a moment of such uncertainty in American politics and in the world that people were desperate for some sense of just what is normal upheaval during a transition like this and just what seems to be exceptional and really a level of uncertainty and dysfunction that's associated particularly with Donald Trump. And so Jim Baker, as a Republican, as one who had reached out to the Trump administration and yet was being critical, I think in many ways his testimony to what we should take seriously was part of the reason why his comments resonated so early on in the Trump administration. That being said, what was my first takeaway? That Donald Trump, above all, is unpredictable when it comes to foreign policy. Unpredictable by design. In his own mind, I think he thinks that means keeping foreign leaders, keeping domestic opposition off guard, never letting them think that he's going to do the predictable and expected things. And in fact, I tested that thesis with one of his national security advisors a few weeks after that Jim Baker conversation, when I sat down in the old executive office building with Michael Anton, one of the early architects of trying to put a Trump doctrine behind the collection of impulses that Donald Trump has articulated as a candidate about foreign policy. Michael Anton is now the strategic director of communications for the National Security Council.
This president has a foreign policy doctrine, but he's not rigid. I mean, I could quote Lincoln again. I wish I remembered these quotes exactly, where Lincoln said something like, someone asked him, what do you do when the facts change? He says, well, I change my response. What do you do? Right? In other words, you don't just hew to a rigid line no matter what happens in the world. You've got to be prepared to respond. And as the president said, he's flexible, and he responded in a way that he thought best.
He's flexible. Is he also unpredictable by design?
Oh, he definitely, I mean, the only thing maybe predictable about his foreign policy is that he says to the world, I'm going to be unpredictable. He's said many times, he said he thinks that America has been too predictable. I think he relishes that, to keep adversaries, competitors alike sort of off balance.
So that was Michael Anton, President Trump's Director of Strategic Communications at the National Security Council, in one of our earlier interviews this year. What was going on at the time he said that? Well, Donald Trump was launching a salvo of cruise missile strikes in Syria, inside Syria, in response to a chemical weapons attack that Bashar al-Assad launched on his own people. And, you know, Trump was very explicit when he did that in saying, I'm doing this because Barack Obama didn't do this.
Look, the president did deliberately contrast his actions with President Obama, which I think is fair. I think that's one of the reasons why he took the action he did. I think he felt that U.S. credibility had been undermined by the stating of a red line and the refusal to act when that red line was crossed, even though he himself hadn't stated a similar red line.
Number two, Donald Trump is, or he hopes to be, the un-Obama. Certainly, that is the case, it seems to me, and many of our guests have talked about this, when it comes to how he goes about foreign policy, how he goes about the job of being the president of the United States. I've sat down over the course of the Global Politico with a number of former very senior officials in the Obama White House. Many of them are very reluctant to criticize, understandably, their former boss when it comes to the foreign policy crises in the world today. But I think they make it very, very clear that there is a major stylistic difference between their boss and Donald Trump. And listen to Lisa Monaco, who was President Obama's chief Homeland Security advisor. She sat, as she recounted in our interview, in a windowless office near the Situation Room for much of the Obama presidency. Every morning she was in there in the presidential daily brief. And here's how she characterized working with President Obama.
He was a voracious consumer of written information, but that wasn't confined to the president's daily brief. That was true across the board. For every meeting you would have with him, he would consume that paper that he was provided. He would get a multiple inches thick binder every night for the next day's meetings with memos and papers for him to consume in advance of all the meetings he would have that day. And he consumed it. Without fail, if you gave him written product, he had consumed it. I likened it to appearing before a tough judge every day. So I'm a former prosecutor, and so I'm used to having that give and take and making sure I am able to provide the answer first and then provide my explanation. The president, engaging with the president was very much like appearing before a tough judge every day.
It really seems as though Donald Trump is very enamored with the same concept of executive action that Barack Obama used at the end of his tenure in the White House when Republicans were controlling Congress and he realized that was the only way to get anything done. Consistently, we have come back to analyzing how the president of the United States goes about making decisions. There's an awful lot of focus in all 6 months of the Trump presidency on trying to get inside the head of the man himself. The psychology of the White House has never seemed more important. And many people, of course, point to the daily stream of direct from the man himself Twitter feed as a way of understanding what the president really means as opposed to the advisors he's surrounded with. This was a point that Tom Donilon, another key Obama advisor, made when we sat down this spring and talked about President Obama's foreign policy and how it contrasts with that of President Trump.
It's important to keep in mind what your affirmative goals are, what your strategic initiatives are, and to make time in kind of in a structured way to ensure that you pursue those goals. If you don't do it in a conscious way, and it can't be done, frankly, I'm trying not to be political here, it can't be done in comments or 140 characters, right? These are efforts that have to be carefully considered, announced, articulated, explained, and then executed on. And I think that that's the real challenge for any high-ranking policy official in the United States is to not just be on the defense all the time, but rather to keep in mind what your strategic goals are. So, for example, President Obama had a goal of pursuing climate as a priority, pursuing nonproliferation in the Iranian deal as a priority, opening to Latin America, including Cuba, and a long list of things. But those wouldn't happen if you just were reactive. Strategic initiative is one of the most important concepts, I think, in American foreign policy. And I think it's up to President Trump to articulate what his strategic initiatives are going to be. It's an interesting thing in the administration thus far. There's been a kind of an odd view that policies don't have to be explained. There's been a real, very small number of policy speeches given by the president and by his team. And I would encourage them to correct that, frankly, and to think hard about where we want to go as a country and articulate that. That's important for allies and adversaries to understand. It's also, frankly, important for the American government, the bureaucracy, to understand.
Just to sum up, points one and two. What have we learned? Donald Trump is unpredictable by design, and he is, or he hopes to be, the un-Obama. What has that meant in practical terms to be the un-Obama? Well, my point number three is pretty clear. They love Trump in the Middle East. Yes, they do. Certainly, it's the leaders in their gilded palaces who are looking for a reset after their frustration with Barack Obama over the last 8 years. In particular, many of them mention their concerns about Obama and the red line in Syria and the question of American leadership, American credibility in the region. Well, in the very first road trip for the Global Politico back last winter, we went to Kurdistan, to Iraqi Kurdistan, just a little bit more than an hour down the road from where the fight was raging in Mosul against the Islamic State. And the Iraqi Kurds, along with other Iraqi forces, were there fighting to push the Islamic State back out of Mosul, which they have now done. But what I was struck by was the fact that this narrative about Barack Obama and actually an optimism towards President Trump was present even in places where I didn't expect it. For example, when I sat down in Sulaymaniyah, Iraq, with a young student there, Issa Muhammad, an aspiring novelist from Baghdad, here's what he told me.
President Trump is an ideal concept for Middle Easterns in general and Iraqis in particular because he fits the loud, strong, and I put strong into quotations here, the loudmouth, the one who will say it as it is, and I put that into quotations as well. So to them, they can see it, Trump is doing something instead of what they saw with Obama, especially with some of Obama's administration. Some of their stuff weren't that much clear. They were vague. So the people got confused by it somehow, especially here in Iraq. One day he says we will never interfere in Syria, and then they do. And then he says if they hit with chemical weapons, we will have troops on the ground, and that's what the regime did, and Obama didn't do anything. So to them, that indecisiveness is not the character of a strong leader, and he's not that much of a loudmouth as much as he's articulate with his words. We don't care about articulation in the words. We care about somebody who's saying it out loud and making all these gestures, because that's what our presidents, all of them, were doing.
Well, you know, it's not just students and people on the street who have this view of Barack Obama and Donald Trump in the Middle East. It's a little bit counterintuitive, perhaps, to hear it, given President Trump's very first action of his presidency was to announce a ban on Muslims from certain countries coming to the United States, one that's still, of course, being challenged and making its way through the courts. Also a little bit counterintuitive, just given his rhetoric about Muslims. Nonetheless, this is a view that we've heard multiple times on the Global Politico, including with various high-level Middle Eastern leaders with whom we've spoken on the program. For example, on that same trip to Iraq, we spoke with Kubad Talabani, the deputy prime minister of Iraqi Kurdistan. And he said something very similar about President Obama.
President Obama, when he came into office, his mandate was to get out of Iraq, which you could say is an America first strategy. This, you know, so, but we saw that getting out of Iraq didn't help Iraq. It didn't help the United States in the Middle East. It didn't help. It didn't help peace and prosperity here. So we're hopeful that America first doesn't mean disengagement. That it actually means more strategic engagement. Strategic engagement with America's allies in the region. Strategic engagement on issues that are of national interest to the United States, of which counterterrorism will always be a top national security issue in the U.S., and we will always remain a valuable ally in the war against terrorism.
I also spoke more recently with Saad Hariri, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, and he was surprisingly optimistic about what Donald Trump might mean for this troubled region, notwithstanding the fact that even when he made an appearance in the Rose Garden with President Trump, President Trump made a gaffe about his country that could have been very politically perilous for Hariri. He criticized Hezbollah without seeming to understand that Hezbollah was in fact a member of the coalition of Hariri's own government. Basically, the optimism about Trump, he said, boils down to clarity and that all-important contrast with Barack Obama. So they like him in the Middle East. But point number four, they don't like him in Europe. They do not love him, in fact, at all. In the spring, I met with former Swedish Prime Minister Carl Bildt in Berlin on the sidelines of a conference with a number of high-ranking European officials, all of whom expressed varying degrees of what I would say was bewilderment, anxiety, fear, and dismay over Trump. When I sat down with Bildt, we talked about how Trump had even tweeted a fake news story about Sweden, an important U.S. ally.
Well, people were appalled. Then there was an element of sort of entertainment. They thought the man had gone bananas the one way or the other. They couldn't really understand it. So there was quite a big reaction to it, and it caused quite a big debate, both concerning the relationships and concerning the issues of substance that he tweeted about. But it was a somewhat unsettling thing to see the President of the United States, without any factual basis whatsoever, launch out against a small country in the way that he did.
Well, I mean, joking aside, in a way, it sort of suggests this culture clash that is happening, where you have a real worldview of Donald Trump, which is so different than than the politics of Sweden or of Europe more generally.
That as well, but it also illustrates the fact that we've been living with presidents of the United States of different sorts, different policies for ages. But we are used to the president of the United States being a person who's fairly well informed, and when the president of the United States says something, it is something of substance, it should be taken seriously. Certainly we're waking up here to a person who's sort of seen something on Fox News in this particular case and makes that the subject of a major public insult, as a matter of fact, to a country. That's unsettling, to put it mildly, apart from the issues of substance, which you can always discuss, and the policy differences that are there, but the way of handling an issue was clearly upsetting, to put it mildly, and we have unfortunately seen a couple of other such cases as well.
Inside Sweden, were there different views depending on the political viewpoints of people?
Not really. It has to be said, as you are aware of, that Donald Trump is probably one of the least popular American presidents on this side of the Atlantic for a very long time. And there have been a couple of others as well.
Well, that's right. We were just talking this morning at breakfast. We're here in Berlin on this beautiful sunny spring morning. And, you know, there's a real sense of Europe spending its time, just like we Americans are these days, kind of trying to get inside the head of Donald Trump. But do you think he's less popular than George W. Bush?
Yes.
Why?
I think it has to do quite a lot with the way he conducted the election campaign, because he conducted the election campaign, again, apart from the substance of what he was trying to say, he conducted the election campaign in a rather brutal and vulgar way. And that we don't like in Europe. We want there to be at least an element of civility in the political discourse, and that was notably absent.
These are not just anecdotes and impressions from Carl Bildt. Look at the numbers, and they're very striking these days. There's only two countries in the world in the Pew Annual Global Attitudes Project that have more favorable views of Donald Trump. I'm guessing many of our listeners can figure out what those two countries are. That's right. They are, in fact, Israel and Russia, the Middle East, basically, and Russia. But when it comes to Europe, not only are Donald Trump's personal favorable ratings down in the single digits in many cases, but there's been an absolute drop-off in the credibility of the United States. More than two-thirds of Europeans and others around the world believed that, whether they liked him or not, when push came to shove, Barack Obama would more or less do the right thing in world politics and foreign policy when it came down to it. The number of people who now believe that is the case with Donald Trump around the world is something like 22% when Pew surveyed that. So it's a pretty stark change in a short amount of time. Number five. It's not just Europeans. That's right. Democracy promoters, many of them Republicans here in Washington, are also beside themselves a few months into the Trump presidency. Because if there's been one consistent theme, it seems to me, of Donald Trump's extensive set of introductory meetings with world leaders, and he's been very active on this front, I have to say. He's been on the phone all the time. He's really engaged in a kind of personal diplomacy. And one thing about his personal diplomacy is that he has no problem whatsoever praising dictators, cozying up to strongmen, and really moving the United States fairly dramatically away from its previous position that democracy matters and is a pillar of our foreign policy and what we're aiming to achieve. Think about some of the things that Trump has said over these 6 months to various authoritarian leaders and tough guys around the world. He called China's Xi Jinping a good man, a very good man. At one point, now again, he's had various wars of words, but at one point, he called North Korea's Kim Jong-un a very smart cookie. Same thing with Egypt's military strongman who came to power a few years ago in a coup. He called Abdel Fattah el-Sisi someone who's doing a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. And when Turkey's President Erdogan came to the White House, he received a fanfare-laden White House reception. And then, of course, there's President Trump's famous affinity for Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose strength, toughness, and leadership have all come in for favorable notice. Not to mention, of course, the fact that he has praised Donald Trump himself. Well, what are we to make of all of this? One takeaway that I certainly have is that the people who've staked their careers on democracy promotion, on human rights as being a pillar of American foreign policy have pretty much given up the hope that for these 4 years, it will still be a crucial pillar of what we do. I spoke with Tom Malinowski for the Global Politico a couple months ago. Tom had just spent the last few years as Obama's Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, a job, I should note, that's still unfilled, as virtually all other assistant secretary posts are at Donald Trump's State Department, because that's another theme that we're seeing is certainly a consistent downplaying of diplomacy and diplomatic efforts, a proposed 30% cut in the State Department's budget, a sense that Rex Tillerson is not in any way, shape, or form the guiding hand behind Trump's foreign policy. And if anything, increasing a trend of recent years that long predates Donald Trump, I should note, which is the increasing militarization of American foreign policy. So Tom and I sat down. We talked about all of this. Before he was Assistant Secretary, he was the Washington Director for Human Rights Watch. And I asked him pretty bluntly, has America gotten out of the human rights and values business?
A president has, unfortunately. I don't think America has. I think that the United States of America has for a very long time had an idea of itself as a country that stands for something larger in the world than just our immediate self-enrichment or self-protection. That idea has inspired us in our moments of crisis from World War II to the Cold War. I think it has inspired people all over the world and sometimes persuaded them to tolerate a bit more power from the United States than they might tolerate from other great powers, because we've managed to convince them more often than not that America uses that power for the common good, for the betterment of the world. When we have not lived up to that ideal, when we have screwed up, as we have many, many times, one thing that brings us back is the sense that we are supposed to do better. And so we judge ourselves in accordance with this very high standard. And all of our presidents really, since Jimmy Carter at least, have explicitly made the promotion of human rights and freedoms and democracy part of our foreign policy. We've always debated how to do it. And I've served under two presidents, President Clinton and President Obama. We had all kinds of arguments about how do we do it in Saudi Arabia? Should we intervene in countries like Syria or Bosnia or Libya when people are in trouble? How do we deal with countries that are our partners on terrorism or security, but that also abuse their people? And we have these arguments about the means, but we've always agreed on the ends. Every president has believed that America's better off if people around the world have greater freedoms. And that is the radical shift that we're experiencing.
But in many ways, perhaps the most revealing conversation we've had on this program about the new politics of human rights and democracy under Trump came in a discussion I had with Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State, of course, and former National Security Advisor under President George W. Bush. Now, she just came out, interestingly, this spring with a book entitled Democracy, a book that she started writing long before anyone imagined Donald Trump would become president last November. She did not endorse Donald Trump in the election and, in fact, voiced many concerns about him. Nonetheless, she was one of the people who advised him to make Rex Tillerson Secretary of State. She's met with Trump in the White House since he became president. And I just listen to the painful and at times even awkward dance that comes up with Condi Rice trying so hard to reconcile in a way the unreconcilable. Here's a president of her party, and yet the values and the foreign policy that he seems to be representing mark a pretty sharp divergence from how she framed foreign policy in the Bush era. Listen to this exchange from our conversation. The president of the United States was inaugurated. He never mentioned the word democracy. He never mentioned the word freedom. That's a pretty stark contrast from President Bush's second inaugural. We've come a long way from the words that you so articulately spoke in your Cairo speech that you mentioned, or by the way, in President Obama's Cairo speech.
Right.
Has America changed direction?
These are early days for this administration, and there's a pretty steep learning curve for a president who has never been in government before, never carried those responsibilities of the presidency. You know, it's a learning curve for every president. But if you're a senator, you've been in and around the Oval, and you know what that room means. If you are a governor, you've been in and around the Oval. Certainly, if you're the son of a president, you've been in and around the Oval. You know what it means. I see, though, a president who's beginning to feel the weight of that office. You know, you can't sit at Roosevelt's desk and not remember the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You can't look at Washington or Lincoln and not feel the weight of history of our country and all of it's been through for democracy. When the president decided to strike Syria, for instance, after the chemical weapons used by the Assad regime, it was a very interesting moment because he said, I can't let that stand. The Syrian babies choking on chemical weapons. He might as well have said, I'm the president of the United States and I can't let that stand. And so let's see how this evolves. I'm looking forward to the president having a chance to go and see what American support for small states like Estonia and Latvia has met for decades, but now as a part of NATO, to go to a place like Israel and see what it's like to be a democracy in a sea of countries that would have destroyed you had it not been for your toughness and your will. And so these are early days, and I think the president and many around him have not been in government. Let's give it a little time.
Just to be so I understand where you're coming from, though, on the foreign policy, do you see that the Republican Party has changed its views toward the role of democracy promotion and freedom and human rights in our foreign policy? You know, that has been associated very much with the Bush administration. Is it still your Republican Party?
Well, I listen to a lot of our senators, whether it is, of course, John McCain or Lindsey Graham, but also listen to Dan Sullivan sometimes talk about these issues, or listen to Joni Ernst. These are people who served for these values and who risked their lives for these values, people who served in the military. And so I don't think my party is going to walk away from the principles. And yes, George W. Bush stood for these principles, but they were probably most strongly articulated by Ronald Reagan. Because when Ronald Reagan talked about peace through strength, he wasn't talking about peace as the absence of war. He was talking about an environment in which justice and liberty could thrive. And so, no, I don't think the Republican Party is going to walk away from this. And ultimately, I don't think the President of the United States is going to walk away from it.
So it's fascinating, I think, that Condi Rice immediately understood that people would associate in some ways the words democracy promotion and the Bush administration with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. By the way, invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly of Iraq, that Donald Trump has been very critical of and that he clearly was reacting against in formulating what he called a much more America-first foreign policy in his rejection of nation building, in his clear discomfort with sending more troops to Afghanistan. We'll talk about that more later in this program. But yes, clearly Trump is reacting very directly to the Bush administration's foreign policy. Well, here's what Rice had to say at the end of our conversation.
But yes, words do matter. And I follow every day what we're saying. I hope that we will say even more, that the world is really a dark place when the United States of America is not involved. It's a dark place when we don't stand up for those who just want to have the same basic values that we have. The right to say what you think and worship as you please and be free from the knock of the secret police at night and have the dignity that comes with electing those who are going to govern you. Because it's really served us best when America leads from power and principle. I'm hoping to hear even more of that.
Well, number six, Donald Trump is no democracy promoter, but there's something else he is, for sure. He loves playing the alpha male. Even before Donald Trump was inaugurated, in fact, one of his more controversial advisors, who, by the way, is still in the West Wing as of now, even though many of his allies are gone, like Steve Bannon, Sebastian Gorka. Gorka said, "It's all going to end on January the 21st. Our foreign policy has been a disaster. We've neglected and abandoned our allies. We've emboldened our enemies. The message I have, it's a very simple one. It's a bumper sticker. The era of the pajama boy is over January 20th, and the alpha males are back." So is Donald Trump an alpha male president, at least when it comes to foreign policy? What is an alpha male anyways? Is it just a synonym for bully? Is it a shorthand way of saying America first? Is it a form of muscular unilateralism, even if the words aren't that well chosen? And by the way, I should say, after I ran my alpha male episode of the Global Politico, I got blocked, I think for the first and only time on Twitter, by Sebastian Gorka. Although all we did was actually quote him saying the era of the pajama boy is over and the alpha males are back. But yes, we convened a pretty interesting group of alpha ladies to talk about what it means to have an alpha male policy in the White House. We brought together Wendy Sherman, who had been a senior State Department official under both President Obama and President Clinton. She was also the lead negotiator on the controversial Iran deal. We had Madeleine Albright, who was, of course, the first female Secretary of State when she became Secretary of State during President Bill Clinton's second term in office. And we had Michelle Flournoy, who was a senior Defense Department official under President Obama, and interestingly, turned down the job of Deputy Defense Secretary for Donald Trump, for Jim Mattis, expressing reservations, as she told us in that podcast, about whether she could really get on board in an administration where she had much respect for Jim Mattis, the general now running the Pentagon, but wasn't sure she would really support what the president was all about. So here's what our alpha ladies had to say about the alpha male foreign policy.
Well, you know, I think tough talk is quite easy. Bullying is quite easy. Getting something done in the world is quite complicated. And when President Trump was in the private sector, some people would say he's still in the private sector, when he was in the private sector and he built a building, it was a very transactional relationship. And if the building didn't get built, then the rich people, who were largely his clients, would go find another building. If you don't get an Iran deal done, you'd probably be at war. And the blood and treasure that I hope someday Michelle Flournoy is our first woman Secretary of Defense has responsibility for is quite a different set of stakes. So I think that one of the things that the analysis of the Trump administration is missing is that whether we like it or not, when you do things in the world, you have to, of course, protect your own interests, but everybody else has interests. And if you want to protect your own, you've got to understand theirs.
So that was Wendy Sherman. Here's what Madeleine Albright, the first U.S. female Secretary of State, had to say about the alpha male foreign policy.
And I think that is going to be a weakness, one of the weaknesses of this administration, the dismissal of views. And so I hope we are not in the world of the alpha males, because they have made an awful lot of mistakes and they prod each other on to more alphaness.
Alpha male is one way of looking at the Donald Trump foreign policy and the view of the world. I think politics and how much that drives him are another, which leads me to our point number 7. Donald Trump's inexplicable politics are actually somewhat explicable. That's right. He loves playing to his base, which is why he'll keep bashing not only the media, but also the leaders of his own party. Because Donald Trump is really reflecting the fact that there's a war within his party when it comes to foreign policy and national security, as much as on anything else. There's globalists or internationalists, there's nationalists, there are many enemies, and there's a real fight for the soul of who's going to be coming out on top of this Trump administration. The press has headed Donald Trump's enemies list for a long time. It's part of what he did in the campaign with great success, and he's continued to do it throughout his tenure in the White House to a degree that really shocks and surprises almost anyone who spent any time covering previous White Houses. Andrea Mitchell, for example, has covered 7 presidents, going all the way back to the end of the Carter presidency. Here's what she had to tell me when we sat down and talked this spring about the Trump White House.
it is totally sui generis. I've never seen anything like this. You know, black is white and white is black, and they mislead you, and it's really disconcerting to see the podium in the White House briefing room being used to mislead or misdirect or obfuscate.
But, you know, in many ways, that's the public theater of the Trump White House. I think it's the political war within the Republican Party that bears the most watching when you're trying to understand, well, just which way is he going to pivot in the world? Look at the attacks in recent weeks on leaders of his own party, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, for example, with the firing of Steve Bannon, the fiery nationalist who helped Trump become president, but then fell out of favor, and who was inside the White House pushing many of these policies, whether it was against trade deals, in favor of pulling out of multilateral pacts like the Paris Climate Accord. He's on the outside now, but that does not mean that his faction has definitively lost. And that was a big takeaway that I had. We sat down and convened two different groups of feuding Republicans recently to talk about sort of the politics of the Trump administration. We had a group of very Washington insiders, and then we had some very fiery pro-Trump activists from the outside, including Roger Stone. He's a controversial figure, as many of you know, I'm sure, a Republican strategist who's long been on the outs, but has also, importantly, been a friend of Donald Trump's for the last 40 years. Stone talked with Trump throughout the presidential race, even when he was purged from the official campaign. He continues to talk to Trump now that he's in the White House. And listen to what he had to say about the war within the Republican Party and how it fits importantly and connects up to this national security conversation.
Perhaps the president thought that once nominated and elected, the Republicans would fall in line around him. I think what he doesn't understand is the division in Washington today is not between Republicans and Democrats. It's between the established elites of the two parties, who are neocons, and the outsiders, those who have not had any influence in government over the last 40 years. And therefore, it was not safe to appoint people who just happened to be Republicans. Donald Trump is a non-interventionist. Donald Trump prefers detente to war. Yeah, he'd like to try to negotiate with Putin before we move to the thermonuclear phase. No, he doesn't think war over Syria or a no-fly zone there is a good idea. That's very antithetical to the two-party orthodoxy, which has run both parties for the last 40 years.
Do you think he should fire McMaster? I noticed that you've been tweeting some of that stuff as that's erupted as a public controversy.
Yes. First of all, the president, when he put out his statement of support for McMaster, he was never informed that McMaster essentially said that the political espionage that Susan Rice engaged in was perfectly all right. The president was also not told that McMaster extended her national security clearance. I'm not sure the president is aware of General McMaster's longstanding relationship with George Soros and other internationalists who are opposed to his agenda. Yes, I think McMaster should go.
Number 8, hope springs eternal, at least when it comes to the members of the Washington establishment, which has constantly been telling me, more or less every single week since we started the Global Politico, that Donald Trump just might evolve, whether it's on issues like NATO and Afghanistan, moving the Jerusalem embassy, or deciding to become more involved in the Syrian civil war. They see examples consistently where Donald Trump's rhetoric, his tweets might be one thing, but that in fact his actions and his actual foreign policy are not nearly so dramatic of a shift as his words and his rhetoric might imply. So definitely there's an element of wishful thinking in some of this, but there's also a view that in Washington, somehow the House always wins. It's a casino that might be a little bit rigged, and the establishment more or less, finds a way to accommodate itself to power. It finds a way to get the attention of even the most disruptive new president and make him conform to the norms of foreign policy, which have been strikingly bipartisan in many cases in recent years. Here's what Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, had to say about this when we spoke very early on in the Trump presidency.
What I see happening is an evolution, okay, where you have someone who was, you know, on a campaign trail. His focus group was these rallies that were taking place. He heard himself say things, and he could see the crowd respond. And in many cases, there was, again, that nugget that is a root of something that's real. But over time, it can be refined and evolve into something that actually creates a good policy. So NATO would be an example.
Look at NATO, where Donald Trump all along has made it very clear he's very skeptical of American alliances, very much concerned that we were being forced to pay more than our fair share with our NATO allies. He caused a great uproar back in May, as I'm sure you'll remember, when he went to a NATO meeting in Europe and refused to endorse the Article 5 protection in the treaty, which basically is the all-for-one, one-for-all mutual defense provision that's at the heart of the NATO alliance. It's the key reason, you know, that many of the smaller countries of Eastern Europe have joined NATO in recent years, concern about their neighbor Russia. Donald Trump eventually, very reluctantly, endorsed this. Same thing just last week on Afghanistan, where he basically said, I don't want to be in there for years and years. He said it was a mistake. We were getting taken for a ride. As president, his advisors kept asking him to send more troops. He kept saying, no, give me better options. And then reluctantly came around to listening and adopting the plan that his advisors offered to him. So is that evolution? Is it not? Is it a flip-flop, or is it merely buying time when he realizes the constraints that the office has placed upon him? Not too long ago, I talked with Laura Miller, who had just been America's chief diplomat for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and she was actually a participant in the room in that Trump policy review process, at least until the end of June, when her contract ran out and they actually shut down her office. Here's what she had to say about the war in Afghanistan and Donald Trump's approach to it.
I don't think there's any serious analyst of the situation in Afghanistan who believes that the war is winnable. It's possible to prevent the defeat of the Afghan government and prevent military victory by the Taliban, but this is not a war that's going to be won, certainly not in any time horizon that's relevant to political decision making in Washington. And so what does that leave you with? A sort of middle ground of do a bit more in order to buy some time, again, continuing to prevent the defeat of the Afghan government, prevent military victory by the insurgents, but not really get you anywhere. And, I think many, even military leaders, many people would acknowledge that what is proposed by those who are advocating the additional investment of military resources is that we have to be there for the long haul, that we have to support the Afghan government for the long haul essentially continue in the same vein that we've been in. Again, not a particularly appealing option for a new president who has been publicly indicating that he's more interested in withdrawing from these kinds of long-term commitments around the world than committing to them, than owning it.
Right.
And so to say to this new president, not so new anymore, but this policy review has been going on for several months, to say that your only option is that now you need to be the third president in a row to own this war, that's a very politically difficult thing to do.
And yet Donald Trump did it. So there you go. Some evidence for those who believe hope springs eternal and Donald Trump just might evolve. However, point number 9, Donald Trump evolve? What are you, crazy? Russia, of course, is the classic example of this. Russia, Russia, Russia has been a defining and somewhat surprising theme of Donald Trump's presidency. In many ways, it's been the thing that not only threatens to ensnare him in this growing web of investigations, and special counsel Robert Mueller is now pursuing the question of whether there was any collusion between Trump, the Trump campaign, and the 2016 election hacking by Russia. But at the same time, as a policy matter, there's just one thing Donald Trump has been very consistent on. He's never, ever criticized Vladimir Putin, given every opportunity in the world, given, I think, the obvious political benefit at a certain point that would have come from finally just bowing into his critics and going in that direction. But Trump has never wavered in this. And even now, as a different policy has more or less been foisted on him by Congress, he's never backed off of his stated desire to have a reset in relations with Russia. Here's what Bob Corker had to say to me about Putin and Trump at the very beginning of the Trump administration. I think it's still relevant today.
He looks at Russia, looks at Putin. He looks at the relationship that we have. I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry. I think that part is somewhat real, but I think what's the major motivation, and this is just me, I certainly haven't heard this from anyone else, it's just my observation. I think that for a person who is breaking glass and wanting to reshape the world and thinks that so much about it is wrong and that the Americans have gotten a bad deal and the way we've done things has been inappropriate, for him to create a different kind of relationship with Russia, especially someone who is strong like Putin, I think he views that as something that would show that he has the ability to do things that no other president has been able to do.
On the other side of Capitol Hill, on the House side, Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, has emerged as one of President Trump's toughest critics, and he's a leader in the unfolding House investigation of the Russiagate matter. He's been particularly adamant about Trump and his stated admiration for Vladimir Putin.
This president has a pathological unwillingness to criticize anything the Kremlin does. Now, it may be as simple as the fact that Putin says nice things about him, that the Russians effectively helped him get elected president, and he has a worldview where you're either for him or against him, and the Kremlin was for him. It may be as simple as that, or there may be more to it involved than that. And one of the things that we intend in the investigation we're doing in the Intelligence Committee is to find out what were all the tools and all the vectors that the Russians used to influence our election. Clearly, they were hacking information. Clearly, they were dumping information. Clearly, they had their paid media platforms, their Russian TV, their Sputnik. They had paid media trolls. But was there more? Was there direct interaction with the Trump campaign or people associated with the Trump campaign?
It's 7 months in, and in many ways, we're still asking some of the same questions, which brings me to my 10th and final point. What have we learned in 7 months of Donald Trump? We've learned, as a result of numbers 1 through 9, that America is now the epicenter of global instability in the world. We're still asking ourselves, is Donald Trump the master of deals or the disruptor? Is he a wrecking ball or a historical change agent? I guess I'll leave it with the last word of a conversation I had with Strobe Talbott, the president of the Brookings Institution, former Deputy Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton, and basically as close as we have these days to a Washington wise man. Here's what Strobe had to say about President Donald Trump and his foreign policy.
I don't want to characterize or cartoonize the President of the United States as a child. He's a septenarian who thinks he can both deal and bully his way through life. It's worked for him in a number of ways before his political career, his extraordinary political career, and he seems to think that it still works. but it has certainly shaken up the world more than I suspect. I hope he doesn't realize how much it has shaken up the world. I had a very high-placed Asian official from a major ally in Asia not long ago, where you're sitting, who shook his head with sorrow and said, Washington, D.C. is now the epicenter of instability in the world, which doesn't mean that there's violence going on here. What it means is something that our friends and allies around the world have taken for granted for 70 years is no longer something that they can take for granted.
So that was Strobe Talbott, and I'm Susan Glasser, and I want to thank you for joining me for this very different episode of the Global Politico. It's been an honor and a privilege to be conducting these interviews and having this conversation with you, the listeners, over the last 7 months. And I really enjoyed the chance to sit back and take stock a little bit. I think we're all trying to puzzle through just what kind of a president Donald Trump is. And it's instructive to see which of our predictions have been borne out so far and which things have surprised us. And most of all, I want to thank you, the listeners, for making this such a fun and rewarding project. And of course, to all these amazing guests that we've had on from the very beginning of the show, I found that Democrats and Republicans, Americans, international interlocutors, people have been willing to sit down and spend time with us in a way that's been very rewarding and has really helped me puzzle through some surprising and unpredictable times. So thanks again to them and to all of you. I'm Susan Glasser at the Global Politico.